What we're going to look at now, vis-a-vis Heusinger, is one of the things that he was responsible for in his position as Chief of Operations and Planning of the OKH. Specifically, what we're going to look at now concerns Adolf Heusinger's executive responsibility for the functioning of the Einsatzgruppen. Those were the mobile killing squads which followed the German frontline armies into this former Soviet Union and liquidated millions of people. Basically just stood them up in front of firing squads and eliminated them. Of Adolf Heusinger's executive responsibility for the Einsatzgruppen, Charles Allen writes as follows in Heusinger of the Fourth Reich. Before the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg after World War II, General Heusinger, during the course of admitting the dominant role that Hitler's Wehrmacht had in the terrible Einsatzgruppen operations on the Eastern Front, in which eventually more than 1,400,000 Jews and twice that many Slavs were slaughtered, asserted that he, quote, merely transmitted the orders, unquote, for these operations. This was his plea. There is no blinking the facts of Heusinger. Even the New York Times, which has never objected to his presence in the United States nor to his ranking NATO post, noted that he, quote, was in almost daily association with Hitler, unquote, from the start of World War II, that he, quote, did his job well and carried out the orders of the boss, Hitler, to the very end. And interesting bit of editorial comment by George Bernard Shaw, again, one of my personal role models and himself a very active anti-fascist. Talking about Heusinger and Hitler, for both, Charles Allen writes, for both fit the role of Bernard Shaw's militarists in his essay On War and Its Great Men, unquote. Quoting that essay, killing by deputy makes killing easier. Hitler has never killed anybody. Other people have done his killing for him. Torquemada never burnt a Jew, nor did King James turn the rack on Guy Fawkes. They had other people do it for them. So when Heusinger had almost 4 million people executed by the Einsatzgruppen, he obviously didn't shoot them all himself, but that was his executive responsibility. However, that profound responsibility for such a barbarous act did not in any way impede the post-war rise of Adolf Heusinger. Again, the fear of communism first, the exaggerated reports of Soviet strength and intentions given to the U.S. by Galen, then the Korean War, set the stage for the revival of the German General Staff, and indeed that stage was being set even before those events took place. Of Heusinger's surrender and his elimination from the list of war criminals, Charles Allen writes as follows. Thus, the last official declaration to the German armies by its commander-in-chief was a most political one. The, quote, state within a state, unquote, the historic German General Staff would be maintained, even as it was following the defeat of World War I. By the way, that's the address by von Dönitz that I alluded to above, or read a section of above. Continuing, World War II would be no different in this regard. The Nazi officer corps was to return home and go over to the Western powers. The bearers of the bloody traditions of Scharnhorst, Clausewitz, Moltke, and Seeckt were to bide their time patiently, and as only they knew how, prepare against the day when they would return to power stronger than ever before to place primary reliance in their newest and, quote, greatest boon, National Socialist Unity, unquote, and to wait upon the march of events when they would join former enemies in the West in retrieving by force, quote, our land from the Russians, unquote. Above all, they were not to resign themselves to defeat. One of the first of the Nazi General Staff to carry out the letter and spirit of what was, in effect, the final order of the day for the German officer corps was Generalleutnant Adolf E. Heusinger. According to his own account, he sought out and surrendered to advancing American troops in early May of 1945. His surrender, of course, was no ordinary capitulation by a mere field officer. Heusinger had, it must always be kept in mind, directed what historians call, quote, the brain and genius, unquote, of the German General Staff, the operations and plan section of the Army High Command, the precise pinnacle where all of the talent, know-how, erudite military technology, and centuries-old experience of the great German General Staff during World War II fused into the person and office of its chief, Heusinger. Moreover, consider the most profound political nature of his position. Heusinger was the single officer who, from 1938 to 1945, conceived, directed, and especially for 3 years on the Russian front, implemented the strategy and tactics of Hitler's plan to Nazify all of Europe and Soviet Russia. His inestimable value as a Soviet, quote, expert, unquote, to the strategists of the Cold War cannot be underestimated. Indeed, his worth may well explain the fact that although in 1944 he had been listed as a prima facie war criminal by some members of the United Nations War Crimes Commission, his name, after his 1945 surrender, was never placed on the list of those to be tried for war crimes. Well, so again, note that Heusinger, in his position as head of the operations and plan section of the Army High Command, was a very, very valuable individual to the up-and-coming NATO, to the, quote, Christian West, unquote. And note that he was never placed on a list after the war of war criminals. And note, his inestimable value as a Soviet, quote, expert, unquote. Well, three guesses where this Soviet, quote, expert, unquote, wound up. That's right, the Galen Organization. And as we're about to see from Charles Allen's text, the Galen Organization itself functioned in some ways in a manner analogous to the way the military microcosm of von Seeckt functioned after World War I. It served as a vehicle for the preservation and ultimate reconstruction of the German General Staff, of Hitler's General Staff. Returning to Charles Allen's text of Heusinger, he writes, his first assignment after the war was with the notorious Galen Bureau in West Germany, where he was secretly employed. The Galen Bureau was set up after World War II by the American State Department and the Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA. It was composed exclusively of former highly placed Nazi politicians, intelligence operatives, Gestapo agents and SS leaders, and several carefully selected Wehrmacht generals, admirals, and Luftwaffe marshals. Here, Hitler's general industriously worked on the time-consuming planning involved in the, quote, assembling of a new German General Staff High Command, unquote. Last sentence again of Heusinger's work for Galen. Here, Hitler's general industriously worked on the time-consuming planning involved in the, quote, assembling of a new German General Staff High Command, unquote. Although this was patently in violation of all Allied agreements at the end of World War II to dissolve the German General Staff and its armies, for Herr General, such work was quite familiar. He had done the same thing during the 1920s when he was selected personally by von Seeckt to train illegally to be a German General Staff officer, while the Germans were secretly building an army in violation of World War I's Versailles Treaty. Herr General had participated as a young staff officer in the secret build-up of the German armies for the Third Reich, and now, 25 years later, was to lead the reorganization and re-establishment of all the armed forces, Army, Navy, and Air Force of a Fourth Reich. West German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer early named him the chief of the new Wehrmacht, now called the Bundeswehr. In 1957, Heusinger became West Germany's first Inspector General of all the armed forces, a post equivalent to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States Armed Forces and the highest military office in West Germany. Last two sentences again. West German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer early named him the chief of the new Wehrmacht, now called the Bundeswehr. In 1957, Heusinger became West Germany's first Inspector General of all the armed forces, a post equivalent to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States Armed Forces and the highest military office in West Germany. Continuing with Allen's text, he led a handful of former Hitler militarists and politicians in exploiting to the fullest the vulnerable position of American policymakers because of their commitments to the Cold War. The New York Times put it bluntly when it reported that, quote, in the opinion of General Adolf Heusinger, it will be impossible to recruit desirable officers for West Germany unless a substantial number of war criminals are released, unquote. Among the war criminals for whom he demanded freedom was the former head of the entire Nazi concentration camp system, which had slaughtered millions throughout Europe during World War II. Heusinger got his way. Most of them were released. It was therefore with what must have been a certain sense of historic mockery that General Heusinger, one of the first to carry out the final orders of Hitler's successor, quote, to maintain the unity given to us by Nazism, unquote, himself ordered the first officer corps of the, quote, new, unquote, Wehrmacht on September 27, 1958, quote, we must remember our past. Let us stick to the old principles, those principles we used to have, unquote. Again, his first direction to the, quote, new, unquote, German officer corps. To maintain, he said, quote, we must remember our past. Let us stick to the old principles, those principles we used to have, unquote. So again, bear in mind some of the things that we've looked at so far. We began by looking at von Dönitz and his farewell address to the Nazi officer corps before the end of the war, forecasting an alliance with the Western powers to regain Germany's lost territories. Galen, before the end of the war, forecasting the same thing. We then saw Galen reporting directly to von Dönitz getting approval from von Dönitz, indicating that the Nazi chain of command was still in effect. Von Dönitz approved of Galen's operations with the Americans. We have then seen how the Naumann organization and the Bruderschaft and the heightening tensions of the Cold War helped to pave the way for the reconstitution of the German General Staff. We've taken a look at the rise of German militarist and ultranationalist organizations directed by Naumann. We've taken a look at the miniaturization program, the military microcosm of von Seeckt, in which Adolf Heusinger took part. And we've seen how Heusinger went to work for Galen and used his work for Galen to lay the groundwork for the preparation of a new German General Staff High Command. He was then placed in charge, he was installed by Adenauer as head of the Bundeswehr, the new German army, or a quote, new unquote German army, was made Inspector General of the German Armed Forces, the equivalent of our Joint Chiefs of Staff, and helped get the release of numerous Nazi war criminals, and instructed the quote, new unquote General Staff to remember our past and maintain the values we used to have. And again, the Galen organization can be thought of as in some ways functioning in a manner analogous to the military microcosm of General von Seeckt, the Truppengeneralstab. Returning again to the new Germany and the old Nazis by T.H. Tettens, of the rise of the new Wehrmacht in the defense ministry and the role in that of Galen, and take note also of the name of Franz Josef Strauss, an individual we're going to come back to, T.H. Tettens writes as follows. The new German Wehrmacht is directed by the young, aggressive, Christian Democratic politician Franz Josef Strauss, whom Time magazine once labeled, quote, the man to watch, unquote. Strauss, of course, Strauss. The British press has called Strauss, quote, the most dangerous man in Europe, unquote. The senior civil servant in the defense ministry is State Secretary Dr. Josef Rust, R-U-S-T, a former colleague and intimate of Globke. Die Welt of Hamburg reported on September 8, 1956, that, quote, of 38 newly appointed generals in the Bundeswehr, 31 were members of the general staff of the old Wehrmacht, unquote. These are the same generals who served under the banner of the swastika and whose, quote, responsibility for Hitler's rule is so heavy and so unmistakable, unquote. The British correspondent Brian Cannell, C-O-N-N-E-L-L, has reported that, quote, most of the leading members of the new German defense ministry were recommended to Adenauer by General Galen, unquote. Again, that last sentence. The British correspondent Brian Cannell has reported that, quote, most of the leading members of the new German defense ministry were recommended to Adenauer by General Galen. And bear in mind, as reported by Die Welt of Hamburg, of 38 newly appointed generals in the Bundeswehr, 31 were members of the general staff of the old Wehrmacht. And again, remember the name Franz Josef Strauss. We're going to come back to him later. Bear in mind, too, the Globke referred to there is Hans Globke, co-author of the Law for the Protection of German Blood and Honor, under which all of the Nazi extermination programs and racial excesses were conducted. He became the first Secretary of State and the power behind the throne being Adenauer, and Galen reported directly to Hans Globke. He was the German official in charge, direct charge of the Galen organization. We're now going to take a look at the ultimate evolution of Adolf Heusinger, and bear in mind the order, basically, the prediction, the forecast, the foreshadowing given by Admiral von Dönitz in his farewell address to the Nazi officer corps, that we must work with the Western powers to regain Germany's lost territories. Galen, of course, had a similar viewpoint, both, by the way, before the end of World War II. We're going to take a look at the continued evolution of Adolf Heusinger and of NATO. Bear in mind, as we've seen in the past, NATO evolved from the Christian West concept. And we're going to take a look at some steps taken by President Kennedy early in his administration. I suspect that perhaps these steps ultimately helped contribute to his assassination. That's speculative, but recall that in our Aryan Nation series, one of the things that we took a look at was the fact that there was a fully armed combat brigade of U.S. troops in the air over the United States, which could have gone any place when Kennedy was assassinated. Had there been rioting or any kind of disturbance in relation to that, these troops could have been dispatched. They were returning from a massive NATO airlift exercise that had been conducted in Germany. That line of speculation was engaged in by Penn Jones Jr. I cannot confirm that that they could have been used in that way. They certainly were in the air over the U.S., and bear in mind that they were returning from the largest NATO airlift exercise ever, and bear in mind now, in that conjunction, the information we're about to go over. Of the continued evolution of Adolf Heusinger and his ultimate appointment as chairman of the Permanent Military Committee of NATO, the highest-ranking military officer in NATO, an individual in a position to affect in a profound way NATO military policy, an individual who was installed directly in the Pentagon, given a suite of offices, placed on the same level as the highest-ranking U.S. military commanders, and, as we'll see, an individual who was in a position to command NATO as a fourth nuclear power. That it was a break from precedent by John Kennedy. Well, Charles Allen writes about the evolution of Adolf Heusinger into basically nuclear Heusinger, chairman of the Permanent Military Committee of NATO. This installed appropriately enough by President Kennedy, or these steps taken by Kennedy on April Fool's Day of 1961. Allen writes, "As soon as President Kennedy entered, the entire room filled with applause for the chief of state of the single most powerful member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The president then formally opened the first 1961 meeting of the Permanent Military Committee of NATO, at which its new chairman was to be installed. The New York Times writer covering the story rightly described the Permanent Military Committee as, quote, the highest military authority of NATO, unquote. Its new chairman, therefore, was to exercise one of the most powerful influences in NATO, as he would, according to the Times, quote, be responsible for recommending military measures to carry out NATO policies, unquote. In effect, the chairman would be a primary strategist for the military affairs of NATO, comprising the Army, Navy, and Air Force contributions of all of Western Europe and the United States. Again, last two sentences. Its new chairman, therefore, was to exercise one of the most powerful influences in NATO, as he would, according to the Times, quote, be responsible for recommending military measures to carry out NATO policies, unquote. In effect, the chairman would be a primary strategist for the military affairs of NATO, comprising the Army, Navy, and Air Force contributions of all of Western Europe and the United States. The president opened the meeting by saying, quote, I am delighted to offer the warm welcome of the United States government to you, unquote. He then made public the decision of his administration to further extend American contributions of nuclear arms to NATO, quote, although he said the precise forms which the NATO nuclear deterrent should take, unquote, would require principally the recommendations of the Permanent Military Committee and its new chairman, who already had made it quite clear that he wanted nuclear arms for NATO without American control over the use of hydrogen and atomic bombs. Last couple of sentences again of Kennedy's address. He then made public the decision of his administration to further extend American contributions of nuclear arms to NATO, quote, although, unquote, he said, again quoting, the precise forms which the NATO nuclear deterrent should take, unquote, would require principally the recommendations of the Permanent Military Committee and its new chairman, who already had made it quite clear that he wanted nuclear arms for NATO without American control over the use of hydrogen and atomic bombs. President Kennedy's announcement of this basic modification of the established American position, American policy from 1949, had been posited on the principle of not setting up NATO as a fourth nuclear power, touched off prolonged applause by the NATO military chiefs. Quote, so let us go forward together in guarding a free community's peace, unquote, he concluded, thanking them for their, quote, defense of the free world, unquote. President Kennedy next turned to welcome the recently appointed chairman of the Permanent Military Committee, who, after his official installation, would preside over the rest of the two-day conference. Quote, I would like now to turn the rest of the meeting over to your new chairman, unquote, the President of the United States said, again quoting, and I would like especially to welcome him here to the United States. General, the President beckoned. The assemblage of the, quote, highest military chiefs, unquote, of the free world then rose and applauded vigorously as a slender, somewhat small man with a slight erect frame, wearing the light blue uniform of the highest-ranking military office of his nation, walked forward to shake hands with the President of the United States. His thin-featured face was broken into lines of smiling appreciation. He bowed his head briefly in recognition of this special installation. He was General Adolf Ernst Heusinger, the Inspector General of the West German Bundeswehr, formerly Generalleutnant of the Nazi Wehrmacht, Chief of Operations and Planning of the OKH, Oberkommando der Heere, of all the land forces of Hitler's armies, and the personal appointee of Adolf Hitler as the last deputy chief of the German General Staff during World War II. By the way, Oberkommando der Heere, OBERKOMMANDO DESHWERES. Continuing. As of April 1st, 1961, he was the chairman of the Permanent Military Committee of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization with offices in Paris and headquarters in Washington, D.C. His suite of offices in the Pentagon was numbered 3E180 and was on the same tier as the highest-ranking military chiefs of the United States. Quite a rise for General Heusinger. Again, one of the top Third Reich military leaders, then becomes head of a newly nuclear NATO, a very stupid thing that President Kennedy did. And also, who knows, what remains to be researched is what possible role Heusinger and subordinates may have played in some facet or another of the assassination of John Kennedy, since it appears that NATO elements, particularly elements of the Galen organization, were at some level involved in the handling of the Oswalds. Now, needless to say, this particular step on the part of NATO, now bear in mind that Heusinger had planned and directed the Third Reich's invasion of the former Soviet Union. This, needless to say, the installation of Heusinger as the highest-ranking military officer of NATO, his installation of the Pentagon, and his control of a newly nuclear NATO, and his advocacy that the hydrogen and atomic bombs of NATO not be subject to American control, this did not set the Soviet Union to doing the varsity rag. My guess is, in the development of the Cold War and the ultimate arms race and the bankrupting and dissolution of the Soviet Union and the virtual bankrupting of the United States in this arms race, this represented a tremendous escalation. It certainly did not thrill the Soviets, and in December of 61, they tried to have Heusinger extradited as a war criminal, obviously not something they had any realistic expectation of getting done. But it's worth noting here, and again, bear in mind, one of the central themes of RFA 37, the strategic use of anti-communism as a vehicle for conquest. It's interesting to take a look at what the U.S. response was. Charles Allen writes, at a huge press conference in Moscow on December 12, 1961, attended by the entire World Press, Radio, and TV News Corps, the Soviet Union announced that, in a diplomatic note just handed to the United States, It had demanded the arrest and extradition of General Adolf E. Heusinger as a war criminal to stand trial for his wartime activities on the Russian front. The terms of the Soviet demand for Heusinger's extradition were based on American-Russian World War II agreements, which are still in full force today. There was no denying the immediate and electrifying effect of the Russian action. That very day, the United States State Department rejected the Soviet note, characterizing the demand for extradition as a, quote, crude and ludicrous propaganda exercise, unworthy of dignifying with any comment, unquote. As might be expected, the bulk of the American press, radio, and TV media loudly parroted the State Department line. Prominence was given to the State Department's lengthy assertions that General Heusinger had been, quote, cleared, unquote, of all such charges, that he was not only never a member of the Nazi Party, but was indeed a hero of the historic July 20, 1944 attempt to kill Hitler, and that any criticisms of Heusinger were, quote, communist-inspired, unquote, to sabotage NATO. One of the points that Alan makes in the course of this book, I'm not going to go into it here, that not only was Heusinger not involved in the attempt on Hitler's life, he was one of Hitler's most ardent defenders after the attempt on Hitler's life, and that actually Heusinger, who was wounded, helped shield physically Hitler from the blast. That was an accident, of course. He didn't know it was going to happen, but Heusinger was one of Hitler's most ardent supporters following the assassination attempt. So, again, bear in mind the orders given by von Dönitz to the Nazi officer corps in his farewell address: we're going to hook up with the Western powers and use them to regain our lost territories. Galen had the same line before the end of World War II. Galen reporting directly to von Dönitz after the war to gain approval for his cooperation with the Americans. One of the terms of Galen's agreement that when U.S. and German interests diverge, he will favor German interests. Bear in mind the history of the military microcosm of Hans von Seeckt. Bear in mind Adolf Heusinger's role in killing millions vis-a-vis the Einsatzgruppen on the Eastern Front. Bear in mind that Heusinger was then installed in the Galen organization and used his position in the Galen organization to help plan the reconstitution of the German high command. He then was appointed head of the Bundeswehr, then Inspector General of the German Armed Forces. The Galen organization played a central role in reconstituting the Bundeswehr from the old Wehrmacht generals. Galen helped select most of the people in the Defense Ministry. Ultimately, Heusinger becoming chairman of the NATO Permanent Military Committee and placed in charge of what President Kennedy reconstituted as a fourth nuclear power. And bear in mind that when the Soviets raised their objection to this, of course, because the propaganda value would have been so enormous of something like that, the U.S. was forced to lie and to characterize Heusinger as anti-Nazi, which he most assuredly was not. And again, anti-communism as the vehicle for conquest, the ultimate hookup of the German general staff with the West, of course, was effected by Adolf Heusinger when he was installed in the Pentagon. As they say in poker, baby, read 'em and weep. Read 'em and weep. We're going to take a musical break now, and we're going to come back, and we're going to take a look at another key Third Reich military functionary, an SS officer named Dr. Theodor Oberländer. We're going to review some of his career, and then we're going to take a look at a profound institution within the quote new unquote Germany, the Expelle organizations, and how they basically functioned in conjunction with the national security establishment of the Third Reich and with the national security and political establishments of the United States. Just as we have looked at the evolution of rollback or liberation theory from a Third Reich psychological and political warfare tactic to a major American psychological and political warfare tactic to a dominant theme in American political life, that theme having assumed its triumph through the assassination of John Kennedy and its ultimate fulfillment in the Reagan and Bush administrations, we're now going to take a look at rollback or liberation theory, and we're going to see it in the context of how it functioned for the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. We're going to take a look at liberation with a new word, the German word Befreiung, and we're going to take a look at just how the extent to which the U.S. adoption of rollback or liberation theory basically made the U.S., in effect, a tool of a reconstituted Reich, at least the institutions of a reconstituted Reich. This is in no way, by the way, to in any way dismiss the pivotal, the dominant importance of American political and national security institutions, but by adopting rollback or liberation theory, they became, in effect, servants of a foreign power, and bear in mind my analysis of the Galen Organization as a Trojan horse. All of this coming up in the next installment of Radio Free America number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War.